Carrot Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk to the author of a new book about farm tourism at museums, markets, and on farms around Wisconsin. First, the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol held its first day of public hearings yesterday. In emotional testimony, four police officers who defended the Capitol that day described being attacked by the armed mob, with some saying they weren't sure if they'd survive. We'll find out how Washington is reacting to yesterday's hearing and more in our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you watch or listen to the first day of testimony yesterday? So what did you make of what you heard from the police officers who'd been there on January 6th? What do you think of the makeup of this committee and its mission? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Jennifer Habercorn covers Congress for the Los Angeles Times. Jennifer, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I want to start with some of the testimony we heard yesterday. This is U.S. Capitol Police Sergeant Aquilino Ganell talking about defending the Capitol back on January 6th. Here's a listen.
When I was 25 years old and then a sergeant in the Army, I had deployed to Iraq for Operation Iraqi Freedom. From time to time, I volunteered to travel on IED-infested roads to conduct supply missions for U.S. and allied forces and local Iraqi population as well. But on January 6th, for the first time, I was more afraid to work at the Capitol than my entire deployment to Iraq.
This is the first big day for this commission. Jennifer, what kind of response did we hear from the political leaders on both sides of the fence, from testimony there from Officer Ganell and others?
It was really startling testimony. I mean, a lot of this is things that lawmakers had heard before, but it had never come from the officers themselves. Hearing their first person accounts and how the events of January 6th personally affected them, I think was something that lawmakers really hadn't been exposed to before yesterday. So it was clearly startling to the lawmakers and, left a deep impression with them and, even some of the reporters who were in the room and anyone watching.
What is next for this committee? It's been a long road to get here. What do we know about their timeline and who they're looking to hear from?
You're right. This is the first time we've heard from them. And, the committee feels like it has a lot of work ahead of them. They are kind of working under a tight timeline, though. They want to get the work done in the coming months. They don't want this to drag on forever. So they're going to be holding more hearings, doing more investigations in the months to come. And I think we'll hear more from them, or at least something comprehensive by the end of the year.
Now, the road here included an effort to make a 9/11 style independent commission that got blocked in effect by Republicans in the U.S. Senate. Now we have this House only thing. Can you remind us what's happened when it comes to Republican members of Congress and their participation or otherwise on this committee?
Sure. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat, of course, wanted this to be a bipartisan commission, and she wanted it modeled after the 9/11 commission, which was made up of Republican and Democratic lawmakers and outside experts. So it was originally designed to be more outside of the political realm, to be, depoliticized, if that was even going to be possible. But it faced a lot of resistance from Republicans. Republicans were concerned that the scope of this was going to be too large. And of course, there was underlying concern that that this commission was going to get into the role President Trump played in encouraging the protesters to come to Capitol Hill and ultimately enter the Capitol. And so Republicans were very opposed to the commission. There were a handful of Republicans who supported its creation. It got through the House with a couple Republican votes. But ultimately, this became a partisan exercise, and that Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, appointed members. Kevin McCarthy tried to appoint members, and they were rejected by Speaker Pelosi because they were viewed as partisan and not committed to investigating what happened on January 6th and how to prevent it. So Speaker Nancy Pelosi ended up appointing two Republicans who feel very strongly that President Trump did play a role in the insurrection, Adam Kinzinger from Illinois and Liz Cheney from Wyoming. So Republicans have overall distanced themselves from this commission, and Democrats have, tried to make it appear bipartisan by including these two Republicans.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Ryan is with us in Wisconsin Dells. Ryan, hi.
Hi, this really isn't a comment regarding the investigation into the incident on January 6th, but just more of an observation in general that a lot of the liberal media and your listeners seem to find credibility when the officers on January 6th said they fear for their lives. But they don't find credibility in officers that say they fear for their lives on everyday use of force cases where an officer has to use deadly force. I just think it's hypocritical of the liberal entourage that seems to continually barrage law enforcement, unless the narrative is something that favors them.
Ryan, thanks for the call. And Ryan's not the first one to point out kind of a flip here. Jennifer, as he says, he suggests liberals or Democrats backing police officers here. Others have observed the irony of people with back the badge signs in some cases attacking police officers and Republicans not believing them. There's kind of a, at least in the popular narrative here, people see kind of a flip.
Yeah, and I mean, the only thing I can say to that is it's really unfortunate that police officers and their actions have become so politicized, you know, whether it's the actions on January 6th or not. We have another group of lawmakers on Capitol Hill who are trying to do policing reform right now, and those efforts are struggling under the weight of partisanship, and there's unfortunately no escape from it.
Thanks for that call, Ryan, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Jennifer Habercorn with us from the Los Angeles Times. She covers Congress there, among other things. We are talking about some of the latest big stories in national news. Turning now to infrastructure and maybe a deal just around the corner. You can call in with your thoughts on that at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jennifer, as we talk, it looks like we're maybe coming up to a countdown on a procedural vote in the Senate tonight on a long, long awaited infrastructure deal. What's going on?
Yeah, you know, we're waiting on with bated breath. This vote does appear likely to happen this evening, but with anything infrastructure, I have to add a note of caution because we've been tracking this for many weeks now, and it always feels like they're about to hit a deal and then something has come up. So if you remember in late June, President Biden and a bipartisan group of senators said that they had a deal on at least an outline for a bipartisan infrastructure plan. It quickly became clear that outline was pretty vague and that the final details were still elusive. Now, at least the group of senators said they have the final agreement. They say that they're going to hold the vote. It needs 60 votes in the Senate. And if you remember, there's 50 Democrats right now. So they would need, assuming they keep all their Democrats, they would need to get at least 10 Republicans. At this point, it appears likely that this first vote is going to be successful, again, with a note of caution that anything can change. But the vote is going to be close, and there's still significant hurdles to remain. This is just the first preliminary vote to formally start debate on infrastructure, and it's still unclear whether there's going to be the votes for final passage, which at minimum would take a couple days to get to. And then you have the House to deal with. There's some friction among Democrats about how big this package should be. There's progressives who are concerned that the moderates are going to balk when they get to the later part of infrastructure, which is the less about roads and bridges and more about shoring up the nation's safety net programs.
What do we know about what this bipartisan deal looks like right now? Some details, it slowed down because the details weren't there. What are some of the key details as you see it, Jennifer?
Sure. It's supposed to be about $1.2 trillion plan. It is largely focused on repairs and new roads, bridges, and broadband internet. That's where most of the money is spent. It's going to go toward improving safety on streets for pedestrians and cyclists. It's going to go toward building new bridges and roads, repairing existing ones. As you are probably familiar with, we have a lot of deficient roads and bridges in this country that lawmakers are eyeing. There's funding in there to shore up existing infrastructure programs like water systems, secure the creation of new ones. So it is very much the quote unquote hard infrastructure, the tangible things that enjoy relative bipartisan support.
There's like a zillion moving parts here, Jennifer, and I don't think we can explore every one of those, but big picture. I mean, we hear about an August recess and we need to get a thing done by August. Is that the thought that if this thing happens, it's going to be sometime before they take the rest of the summer off?
It's not going to be complete by then, but the goal is to get them through the Senate by the August recess. And so if they can do that, I mean, that's a pretty tough climb right now. The Senate does not move fast on anything. And so getting this done by the August break is going to be difficult. But that's the goal that the majority leader, Charles Schumer, has put out there. Then the House would come back and work on their portion of the package. And then at some point, assuming that the House and Senate passed different bills, they'd have to be merged. And it's going to be difficult. I mean, Democrats have small margins in each chamber. In the Senate, you have literally no room to spare. Keeping the progressives and moderates together on a plan while keeping some Republicans for this bipartisan piece is going to be really hard. So realistically, this is going to get done if it does get done in the fall.
Talking to Jennifer Habercorn from the Los Angeles Times. She's with us today for a weekly look at some of the top stories in Washington, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you hoping to see a bipartisan infrastructure package pass the Senate and then the House? How important is new funding for roads and bridges to you? Do you think infrastructure should include more than just that physical stuff and go into things like childcare and other human infrastructure, as the Biden White House has called it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look at some of the top stories in national politics. Jennifer Habercorn is with us from the LA Times. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see Congress pass this infrastructure deal? More and more details coming out. Maybe a procedural vote in the Senate tonight. Still a lot of twists and turns, likely. How about a bigger deal that Democrats might try to pass through reconciliation to do a lot more than just the roads and bridges and whatnot? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Jennifer, we've mostly focused on this infrastructure deal, the smaller one, the more traditional concept of infrastructure. You alluded earlier to the other stuff that Democrats want to do, and they'd probably have to go it alone without any Republicans, or maybe with just a couple few, with this reconciliation process. What's the talk about that part of it right now?
Yeah, that part is very much on the mind of progressives who really want to see that happen. But it's really on the back burner at this point because there's so much focus on getting this first part done. But the second part is about $3.5 trillion in spending, which is quite a lot. And it would instill child care and elder care programs. It would provide an expansion of Medicare to include vision, dental, and hearing aids, which is really popular with progressives and probably with people on Medicare. So it's really about shoring up the social safety net we have in this country and rebuilding that. And Democrats who support these programs argue that the COVID pandemic has only reinforced how important things like childcare are into building back a stronger economy. So those measures, a lot of folks are talking about what they want to see in there, but it's really not moving until the bipartisan portion is done. One thing that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said that is that she won't do the bipartisan part of this until the partisan plan is underway so that they know that the moderate Democrats in the Senate aren't going to just vote for the bipartisan plan and then run when it comes to the part that progressives really want.
Go back to our callers now with Dan in Frankville. Dan, hi.
Yeah, I'm worried that I think after Vietnam, the country basically went bankrupt because Nixon took us off the gold standard, which means that you're just printing paper money. It has no value and stuff like that. Only has value if you think it's worth it. And they're going to print. They've printed off so much money already. Inflation's starting to kick in. There's no manufacturing in this country, which creates wealth. So you're just pushing. The children, no one will ever be able to pay this debt off. So,
Dan, thanks a lot for the call, Dan. Now, there's worry about inflation and some of the COVID relief bills that passed weren't kind of paid for by other spending cuts or revenue. At least in theory, Jennifer, this bipartisan deal, they've got so-called pay-fors. There's an idea of that, hey, this money is coming from somewhere, so this shouldn't contribute to inflation. What do we know about those pay-fors?
That's right. We don't have full details about the pay-fors yet, but this Republicans say that this plan will be fully paid for. There is some unspent COVID funds, as you mentioned. There's a couple Medicare cuts that are likely to get some resistance, but this bipartisan part is paid for. As far as the partisan part, the reconciliation, the $3.5 trillion that we talked about, that's where it gets really dicey because, as your caller alluded to, there's a big concern about this spending and inflation. And that's why I think you're going to see no Republicans support that measure. And even some moderate Democrats are expressing some real concern about that really significant price tag.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Jennifer Habercorn from the LA Times, looking at some of the top stories in Washington. And still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to a caller on committee hearings on the January 6th insurrection. Linda is with us in Lake Villa. Linda, hi.
Hi. I was watching all of the coverage that we could get on January 6th. And so we saw a lot of what was going on. And when I'm hearing a couple of the callers that, someone has cast doubt on the police officers' testimony. And I just am thinking, I remember how many times we saw some of the same shots over and over and over of people that they were in the auditorium, I think, and it had two levels of balconies, and the people who had been meeting down below on the main floor were scurrying to get up into the balcony, and one man helped a woman, I think in a red suit, get down on the floor. You could see them scurrying because there was so much shooting going on. That's one thing. And the other thing is, was there not even one Republican at the Capitol that day that also could be a witness? So what about all those other people that surely would corroborate everything that those fine officers were saying?
Linda, thanks a lot for the call. Other kinds of witnesses who were at the event, apart from police officers, are we expecting to hear from them, Jennifer?
I think we're going to hear more from people who were involved that day. And, to your caller's point, it is there were a lot of eyewitnesses that day who saw what happened. And it's really how people characterize them today and in the days after January 6th that have really diverged, unfortunately.
Thanks for that call. Jennifer, I want to take a few moments on a story that you've been following that hasn't been in our headlines, at least not here in Wisconsin. Wildfires and a Pentagon program that helps the firefighters deal with this wave of fires. The season keeps going, getting longer and longer. Can you tell us about this high-tech program that's been helping?
Sure. This was a really interesting program. Obviously, California cares a lot about wildfire prevention and trying to fight wildfires. So 2 years ago, a program was created called FireGuard, which relies on satellite information from NASA, NOAA, as well as the infrared satellites that regularly scan the United States to detect for enemy missiles. Someone realized that those missiles, that those satellites that scan for missiles can also see fires, whether they are fires starting somewhere out in a remote area or a fire that's already underway. So they use the satellite information to help firefighters on the ground. They can say, hey, a spark started in this remote forest, you might want to check on it. Or they can say, this wildfire that's already well underway, the hot spots are here and here. So this program started in 2019. It quickly became very popular with the firefighting community. But it relies on this access to these military satellites that the military only provides on a temporary basis. And there's efforts on Capitol Hill to ensure that that program can become permanent. And Adam Schiff, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, who is from Los Angeles, told me that the Department of Defense is reluctant to keep this program going permanently, because obviously the Department of Defense is much more focused on its warfighting capability and does not regularly involve themselves in civilian issues. So it's running into some friction with that. So we're going to be following this issue to ensure that this to see what happens with this permanent access.
If nothing changes, Jennifer, when does this run out? When will firefighters be left without this helpful information?
September 30th is the latest deadline that they're looking at right now. And that's usually when California wildfire season, unfortunately, gets much more intense. And I should add that this program scans the entire country. So obviously, wildfires is not a huge issue in Wisconsin, but they are looking throughout the West where wildfires are a big concern and elsewhere as well.
Jennifer, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to chat with you.
That's Jennifer Habercorn. She covers Congress for the Los Angeles Times. She is with us today for our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. A new book takes a tour of Wisconsin's farms and farmers markets. There are markets and farm tours, educational opportunities, and even farm stays where you can get a taste of life on the farm. We're talking now about agritourism in Wisconsin, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite farmers market in Wisconsin, big or small? What's the best food you've ever gotten there? Have you gone on a farm tour in the state, or do you hold tours on your farm? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Christine Hansen is a Milwaukee-based food and travel writer. Her latest book is Wisconsin Farms and Farmers Markets, Tours, Trails, and Attractions. Christine will be at Boswell Books in Milwaukee next Wednesday, August 4th at 7 p.m. Christine, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I could tell from your book, you are a fan of farms and checking out what's going on farms and produce. What got you so interested in farm tourism?
Gosh, you're asking me to choose just one farm. That's a tough one. You know, one of my favorites is a creamery up in Malone off of Highway 45 called LaClaire Family Creamery. And you can go there and literally spend the entire day. Now they make goat cheese. So they have goat yoga with baby goats. Fantastic, right? They also sell their award-winning cheese in the store. They have a cafe with a restaurant. You can watch the goats through the glass windows. You can watch the cheese being made. And I just think it's a fantastic example of agritourism, really showing visitors what's happening. There's no secrets. Everything's out in the open.
Wisconsin has a lot of opportunities to do farm tourism, an embarrassment of riches, really, which I guess gave you enough to write about in the book. What are some of the things you recommend people start to look for, maybe just in their own neck of the woods?
There's so much to explore. In the book, I talk about farmers markets, and I was so delighted that really in the entire state, I would venture to say that everyone lives within a few miles of a farmers market. They're in every town. It's part of our culture here. In terms of farm stands, visits, you know, one of my favorites that I only discovered when researching this book is Together Farms up in Eau Claire. They have grass-fed burger nights, and they have a full bar, which of course serves Liney's Summer Shandy.
When people go to a farmer's markets themselves, that's probably the most familiar kind of farm tourism people do, I bet. I don't know. Do you have secrets? What should we be looking for? How can we make sure we get the good stuff?
That's a great question, because I think a lot of times we just assume what is out on the table is all that's available to us, right? Or what's available in the stand. And, you know, in recent years, I've really started to get to know the farmers more and ask them questions to kind of help me forecast in my own home cooking, you know, such as, you know, when do you think that your heirloom tomatoes will be available this year? Then I can start thinking about all those tomato recipes, right? And another tip that I have is never feel like you have to purchase the entire allotment of what's available. Last summer, I was at a farmer's market in Greenfield, and I didn't want 20 jalapenos. It's way too much, right? So I said to the person at the stand, could I give you half of this amount and take home half? And she said, sure. So we should always feel like we can negotiate, but obviously never at the expense of the farmer's livelihood.
Talking to Christine Hansen about her new book, Wisconsin Farms and Farmers Markets, Tours, Trails, and Attractions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you make it a point to go to farmers markets in your community or when you are roaming around the state? What is your favorite farmers market? Have you been on a tour of a farm? And if you're a farmer yourself, what's life like on the other side? Do you like to bring people onto your operation for a tour? What's it like going to farmers markets and meeting your customers in person? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Christine, you mentioned in the book, you love that you're not just getting to check out the farms, but meeting the farmers themselves. And you write that there's a lot more variety demographically among the people doing farming in Wisconsin than people might expect. What do you see out there?
Absolutely. You know, when we think about a farmer, we think about an elderly man in overalls, maybe like the American Gothic painting with the pitchfork and the homestead behind it. But actually here in Wisconsin, we have such diversity. We have a lot of Hmong families farming together across generations. We have here in Milwaukee, I'm based in Milwaukee, Venus Williams with Alice's Garden. She's a Black woman farming on the near north side. There's also one of the farmers markets I talk about in my book is Oneida Farmers Market, which is near or on the Oneida Reservation up north. And you can get, you know, the expected vegetables, but you can also get bison meat. You can get sweet grass to burn with sage for smudging. And then in Madison, my Spanish is not that great. El Mercadito de Centro, which is on Badger Road, you can pick up a lot of ingredients that you would use in Latin cooking, including tortillas and other vegetables. So I think we're really blessed with an amazing variety of ingredients.
I know there's been a concern that people, especially people I think who live in cities, are distant. They're disconnected from the sources of their food. Is that part of a gap you're trying to bridge in part with your book?
Absolutely. You know, one thing that people can do if they do not live near a farmer's market or a store like Willie Street Co-op or Outpost Natural Foods is subscribe to a farm's community-supported agriculture subscription. And so what that is, if your readers don't know, is that you're committing in the spring to so many weeks of fresh produce from that farm. And they often have pickup points in the city. They'll come into Madison or Milwaukee or Eau Claire or Green Bay. And that's a really great way to ensure that you're getting the vegetables and fruits that you need and probably crave, but you're also supporting a local farm in the process.
I want to start looking at some of the specific types of farm tourism that people can do. Here's one that sounds good to me, the pizza farm. It takes the concept of pizza and puts it on a farm. What kind of things, what are pizza farms and what do they do?
I'm so glad you brought that up because I love talking about pizza farms. It's a personal favorite of mine in terms of what type of farm I want to visit, but it also is something that's unique to Wisconsin. We're very blessed here in Wisconsin. We already know, you and I, but other people know how to make really good cheese. They know how to grow fantastic vegetables, cure meats. And so what a pizza farm is, it's a farm that is creating baking pizzas in a wood burning oven with ingredients that are all either sourced from the property or just up the road. And in some cases, that may even include the grains that go into the flour. So it's a very local pizza. And of course, being Wisconsin, you can get beer with your pizza and live music, of course.
And then another opportunity, I think a lot of people have probably experienced, is some form of pick your own, whether that's strawberries or pumpkins or apples or you name it. How common are those kind of things around the state?
Those are really common. And I knew that before I sat down and wrote this book, because I have a really fond memory, which I actually include in the book, of going to Thompson Strawberry Farm in the late 70s. An example of a farm that's been around a while. But what I didn't realize till I sat down to write the book is how you could probably do U-Pick farms from mid-June to late October. And the reason is that there are so many crops. Starts with strawberries and blueberries in June, and then it gets into raspberries, and then you get into apples in August and September, and now you're into pumpkins. It's not so much picking, it's more picking up off the ground, right? But it really, you know, you could spend multiple months doing that here in Wisconsin.
I don't know, maybe it's all in my head, but the self-picked, or as one place calls it, self-plucked produce tastes better to me. Is that just in my head, or do you think there's really something to that?
I think it's because it's so fresh. I know when I buy vegetables and fruits at the farmer's markets, they last several weeks, and that's because it's probably picked that morning, the evening before. If you're purchasing at a grocery store, you know, there's a supply chain in place, right? It has to go through different channels. And so you really, if you want the freshest, both in taste, but also for longevity, these farmers markets are really the way to go. Or farm stands, that's another option.
We're talking to Milwaukee-based food and travel writer Christine Hansen about her book, Wisconsin Farms and Farmers Markets. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. If you've ever taken a class at a Wisconsin farm school or folk school, farmers, do you give tours of your farm? Do you like to pick your own fill in the blank there? Which one do you look forward to, which season do you look forward to during the year? Do you have a favorite county fair or corn maze? What's your favorite way to get in touch with a farm and produce life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Call in now or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Christine Hansen about her new book. It's called Wisconsin Farms and Farmers Markets. She takes a tour of the many tourism opportunities in Wisconsin available for all aspects of food production and not just food. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your favorite. Pick your own farm or corn maze or farmer's market. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go to our callers now. Dwayne is with us in Wausau. Dwayne, hi.
Hey, when you mentioned pizza farms, we just found out about this place called Stony Acres over by Athens, Wisconsin. So I'm in Wausau, so it's like 30 minutes west. And it's a gorgeous farm out in the country. It has these big brick fire oven pizzas, and all the ingredients are, he grows the fennel, the basil, oregano, all the dairy is done there, and it's all organic. But then he has music too, like, you know, singer songwriter type duets, and the kids have places to play. It's almost like you're going to a cousin's farm in the country, but it's open to the public and it's free. And we just found out about it. I wish I'd have known about it years ago, but and the pizza was amazing. And, you know, anyway, Stony Acres.
Excellent.
Farms.
Dwayne, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Christine, it sounds like, you know, it's a meal. Yeah, but it's an event too.
Absolutely. And I had to put Stony Acres Farm in the book, just as your caller said. It's a really fun place to go. Tasty, obviously, but also entertainment filled. And that is actually a third generation family owned organic farm. And we see that a lot here in Wisconsin, where the younger generations are, you know, sort of readapting the farm for today, more modern ideas. And Pizza Farm is a pretty modern idea. It's a newer arrival in our state.
Joanne, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Anne now in northern Wisconsin. Anne, hi.
Hi, what a great subject. I love this. I have a small farm up in northern Wisconsin. I'm a first-generation farmer, and I run a CSA and have, like, grass-fed beef that we sell to our CSA customers. So it's pretty exciting to see kind of the landscape of farming changing a little bit, and we host events at our farm for our CSA customers. So it's really fun to get to know and see the people who are taking advantage of some of the fresh vegetables and meat that we grow on our own farm.
And Anne, at your CSA, Community Supported Agriculture, like how many shares, how many members do you have in your operation?
Well, it grows each year. So we started out really small. So we're up to about 50 members this year.
And thank you so much for sharing that story, Christine, a first generation farmer there, getting into the CSA game. And 50, that's decent sized. I belong to one that only has like 10 or 12, but there are big and small ones around the state, right?
Exactly. And I love that Anne called in, because while I did mention that we see a lot of family members readapting the family farm, we also see people getting into farming as the first generation, just like Anne is. And I love those stories. You know, another story in my book, which your caller might appreciate, there's a farm called Lucky Break Acres in Elkhorn. And this couple moved from Las Vegas, of all places, to start this farm. It's an 1830s former dairy barn, and they chose Wisconsin. They could have moved anywhere, right? So we are getting a lot of people who are excited about farming and maybe don't have the knowledge, but they're learning. And we have such a peer-to-peer network here in Wisconsin that's really open to sharing information.
And thanks a lot for sharing your story. Larry joins us next in Kingston. Larry, hi.
Hi, I like the farmer's market at South Shore in Bayview. There's all kinds of vendors down there. There's people walking, riding their bikes. You see every race in the world down there. There's Chinese, Japanese, Spanish people, white people, fishermen coming in off the lake. You can see the lake, and they, you know, they're cleaning their salmon right there. It's really cool.
Larry, thanks a lot for plugging a local farmer's market. I was hoping some people would do that. Christine?
Yeah, you know, I actually live in the Bayview neighborhood, and I go to that market regularly, and your caller is right. It's a fantastic example of different ethnicities of farmers. We have a lot of Hmong farmers at that market. There is a guy playing an accordion, like an old organ. I'm not sure what type of instrument, but it's so classic. And then you have Rushing Waters selling their salmon and trout, which is about 45 minutes south of here in the Elkhorn East Troy area. And, you know, when people ask me, what's your favorite farmer's market? For me, it's not so much what's sold there, but I like to have atmosphere, right? I like to have live music and see people I know in the community. And then I like to, you know, I'm a big fan of pastries, so love to pick those up and sit on the grass and watch the lake. And it's all good. It's perfect weekend.
Thanks for the call, Larry, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Christine Hansen about her new book, Wisconsin Farms and Farmers Markets. Back to your calls now. Kathy is with us in Milwaukee. Kathy, hi.
Hi. I wanted to know if Christine knows of any place where people can take a tour of a slaughterhouse so they could see what really happens to farm animals.
Kathy, thanks for calling in. Kathy wanted to see, I guess, a more controversial side of things. Christine, did you look into that?
I did not. I'm actually a vegetarian. I don't eat meat, so I can understand why you're concerned with that topic. In my book, these are all very small, family-owned farms. None of these are owned by corporations. There are no slaughterhouses in this book. They all talk about how they raise the animals humanely. And, you know, one farm in particular, I don't remember the name of it, but her name is Britt. And she wrote this beautiful blog post about how saying goodbye to these animals can sometimes bring tears, right? you know, you get to know them and they're part of your family. So I just want to stress that I really focused on the humane way of raising animals in this book.
Let's go now to Tyrone in Milwaukee. Tyrone, hi.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
What did you want to ask about?
Well, I wanted to share a few things. Well, I'm celebrating my birthday anniversary today, 63 years.
Yay.
Thank you.
Happy birthday.
I thank you. I love what I'm hearing. I love pizza. I don't do a whole lot of meat. I love chicken, fish. Some beef, you know, but I would love to get some of that bison. That sounds really juicy on a barbecue grill there. You know, my heart goes out to the animals. We got to eat something, though. But I would love to hear more about, you know, the farms, the fruits, you know. And you know, let's bring our you know, I went up to Oneida to play the bingo and stuff there. But we need to bring our indigenous native brothers and sisters in on the land with, you know, the treaties and everything, you know, about, you know, climate change and all that. We need the help.
Tyrone, I gotcha. We don't have too much time left. Tyrone had a lot there. Christine, he did mention bison, though. Do we do much of that? Did you visit any bison farms in Wisconsin?
I did not visit any bison farms. Most of the livestock animal farms are in the northwest part of the state. So that would be most likely where you would see it. It still tends to be on a national level, more in the Dakotas and Montana. But as I mentioned, the Oneida Farmers Market does sell bison. And I realize that's quite a haul from Milwaukee, but, you know, maybe a reason to take a road trip.
Tyrone, thanks a lot for the call. Christine, in our last minute, can you just make a pitch for people to get out and check out their local farmers market or you pick farm or you name it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the things we didn't talk about, Rob, is this opportunity to spend the night at a farm, which is amazing for those of us who live in cities and want a little bit of nature. Maybe we want a window into what it's like to be a farmer. And there's so many options. One of my favorites is called Circle M. M is in Mary Farm in Blanchardville. Chris Marion has set up these adorable little vintage remodeled trailers, and you can spend the night in those. I know someone who uses that as a writing retreat several times a year, can wake up to the chickens and harvest their eggs and just like learn about what it's like to live on a farm, and you get to go back to your house. So it's just a little test.
Christine, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Milwaukee-based food writer Christine Hansen telling us about her latest book. It's called Wisconsin Farms and Farmers Markets, Tours, Trails, and Attractions. Christine will be at Boswell Books in Milwaukee next Wednesday, August 4th at 7 p.m. And you can keep sharing your own farm tourism experiences or your favorite farmers markets over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org.